everybody. Welcome to Liberty and Friends, your weekly installment of All Things Freedom, brought to you, of course, by the Institute of Race Relations and in support of the Big Liberty Show. Guys, welcome to the show. I'm your host, Big Daddy Liberty, and I'm super, super glad to be bringing you today's topic, insofar as it's an important one. It's one that speaks to making you more aware of what's happening around the state of crime in South Africa. Are you safer today than you were a year ago? So the Minister of Police, if you aren't aware, who was flanked by his senior aficionados from the South African Police Service, appeared before Parliament to release the latest crime statistics. That's for the year, the financial year of 2018-2019. So this is all the data that ends to about March of this year. He in his usual sort of charismatic way, had a chat with us as South Africans about what the state of crime is like in this country. But if you missed it, maybe because you're at work or, you know, you were carting the kids around or whatever you may have been doing, I'm bringing you two colleagues from the Institute of Race Relations, analysts and guys who have crunched the numbers, who know what's going on, and they're going to talk us through this today. So who do I have in studio with me this week? I have, of course, Herman Pretorius, who is an IRR analyst. Herman, good day. How are you doing?
Excellent. Yourself, Sifle?
Fantastic, brother man. And, of course, a voice and face on the various shows that we have that you guys are familiar with, Marius Ruert, who's also a senior analyst here and, of course, the head of campaigns. Marius, brother, how are you?
Yeah, Sifle.
Hey, man. Just a quick shout-out to Marius, of course, who turned 40 yesterday. Homie's back from what I can only assume was a crazy night of partying. Brother, happy birthday. Happy belated birthday to you.
Thanks a lot, Sifle.
Awesome, guys. Just quick one before. Before we head into the topic, how do we find you guys on social media, Herman?
Well, on Twitter, I'm at Munir_Mon. That makes sense.
Awesome, brother man. I'll have those links, of course, in my descriptor of this podcast. And Marius, how do we find you?
On Twitter, my handle is at MariusCRuert.
Awesome, guys. Let's get straight into this conversation. Fellas, I began this conversation by essentially saying, we're about to talk about the crime stats that happened in the last financial year. So basically everything from up until March of this year, 2019. And I don't know how to even preface this and where we'll begin. So this is how maybe we'll break down this conversation. It'll be a short 25-minute conversation or so. Let's look at the different categories of crime through three areas that we care about as liberals. And this is life, liberty, and property. So when I talk about life, we're talking about South Africans' quality of life. So some of the crime categories, of course, will be things like murder under that, et cetera, et cetera. When I talk about liberty, a very topical thing that we've been discussing, for example, for the past couple of weeks is, you know, some of the crimes that affect people's freedoms to either move around, associate, be in open spaces, and gender-based violence crime-based crimes come to mind here, and crimes against children. Of course, the last one will be on property-related crimes. So I hope this is a nice way of maybe breaking it down, but, you know, if it doesn't work, we'll figure it out. So let's begin on the quality of life of South Africans in this country. Chaps, the murder rate is a major, major, major concern. We've been hearing it in the chattering classes of how Syria is even safer than us in terms of the murder rate. But let's actually look at the numbers. Herman, what are we here today and why is this a big problem?
Well, it's a big problem because people are dying. People who shouldn't be in vulnerable positions are. And, I mean, that's a huge, huge failure. But looking at the data, we see a 3.4% uptick in the number of murders. And that translates to, I think it's 21,022 or something like that. And, I mean, that's 20,000 people who
snuffed out.
Lives gone, potential gone, families broken up, and it's heartbreaking. And to contextualize that, we can put it in the per 100,000. We take the number of cases and then per 100,000 to see what's the homicide rate. And here we see something interesting. In 95, 96, we had it was the absolute high point of our homicide rate, where we had 68 murders per 100,000 people. And then that fell to 31 murders per 100,000 people in 2012 and 2011, 2012. But the problem is we are now back up to 36 per 100,000. It's been ticking up continuously from 2013. And I mean, that's worrying. That was a positive trend, probably the most positive trend with regard to crime in South Africa, and it seems to be fundamentally reversing.
And it should worry us more because of all the categories of crime, you know, the reliability of data can be a little sketchy. However, murder is the one that's actually relatively accurate.
Yeah, have to report, well, most people, if they see a dead body, they'll report it to police. It's one of the best ways to monitor or to compare us to other countries because lots of other countries, for example, crime of sexual offense, they might have a different definition, for example, but a murder is a murder. There's, it's a single definition that all countries in the world follow. Mm. So, and I mean, we all know the difference between the murder rates of South Africa and, I mean, Harriman put something together and shows that the murder rate for Rwanda for per 100,000 people is 23, and Botswana it's 18. So we actually almost double.
Zimbabwe is 11.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem here is, as Maurice is quite clearly saying, that there's something fundamentally wrong here. Mm. It's not just that South Africa is an African country or a poor country or a divided country. I mean, Zimbabwe has more than half our murders per 100,000 people. It's insane.
Well, let's look at this in terms of some of the social issues maybe behind it, because when the police were pushed on this in the press conferences and, of course, in Parliament, it sort of devolved into a wishy-washy word salad, if you will, of them saying, well, you know, we're going to work with NGOs. In fact, the police minister himself said, you know, we need to look at maybe bringing in psychologists and sociologists to help us break it down. But there's two firm things we know. Number one, these crimes, contact crimes in particular, murder, are happening over the weekend. And the police themselves have deduced that, you know, the driving factor of this is alcohol consumption.
Drugs.
And likely drugs also. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so the big social crime element that drives off also something like a murder. The other thing that we know in definite terms, if you will, is that I can't think of the percentage now, but the largest proportion of these crimes, I think it's 29% of the crimes, are from interpersonal, people who know each other, essentially.
Yeah.
So an argument that heats up and one in a rage, you know, kills someone else, et cetera, et cetera. These are social issues, aren't they? Yeah. And I hate to say this because it makes it sound like, you know, maybe trying to defend the police, but policing can't solve this. Unless you're putting a cop in everyone's home, policing can't solve this. So what do we do, Herman?
Well, I mean, one of the things you always say, Sihle, is you feel very strongly about the family.
Yeah.
And I absolutely agree with you there. And if we look at South African history, families were broken up in this country. The Group Areas Act, I think it's in the very first chapter of the brilliant book Gang Town about the gang situation in Cape Town. It's basically there that parents now have to, where they, in the past, a mum and dad had to travel 20 to 30 minutes, an hour perhaps, to their work. Mm. Because they now have been moved to the very peripheries, the edges of society, now they travel an hour or more. And per week, that means to and from work, the kids in that home have 10, 12, how many hours they spend not with their parents, where in the past that would have been part of, you know, social cohesion.
Yeah.
And if you take that over years and years and years, and the snowballing effect, I mean, the causative factors given here was, as you say, the misunderstandings or arguments and confrontations, gang-related incidents, and domestic violence, in that order. Now, the fascinating thing is, I'm tempted to pull all of those back to the disintegration of family structures, or at least societal structures. We don't have to be addicted to the nuclear family, but there's very much this idea that misunderstandings or arguments, there's a rage issue, people don't know how to respond to confrontation properly. I think that's a home issue. Gang related, that's a home issue. You don't feel at home, you need a society, you need somewhere to belong. And then of course domestic violence is, we have generations of mostly men who have no idea how to solve or how to work within the context of a home with confrontation. And this, I mean, it's awful. It's really awful.
And maybe let me come in here, because the very next category, in terms of the largest circumstances leading to murder in South Africa, is mob justice, which comes in at 14%. So Hadman was right. In terms of the sources or circumstances leading to murder, arguments or misunderstanding rated at 30%, and these situations are often beyond the police control, as we said. The gang related, which came in second, is 19% contributory factor, and of course domestic violence at 18%. And we did, I think, rightly situate this at the family level and some of the social networks within a community that just aren't supported as much as perhaps they should be. But the one I was very interested in, because it links into a conversation I had with Gideon Hubert in the previous one of my previous podcasts last week on Liberty and Friends. You can find that on the Daily Friend website and the Iona website. We spoke about, let me just quickly begin here. So mob justice as a contributory factor of vigilantism was 14%. That is a very big contributory factor to the murder rate in the country.
And those are murders. Let no one be, there's no justice.
No two ways about it.
Those are murders.
And here's the ticker, though. And I want to put this to you, lads, and see what you have to say or think. When I spoke to Gideon Hubert, the issue we raised was the idea that South African police, generally speaking, have almost lost the consent, if not lost the consent, to police the South African public. So that you can have, as the fourth highest contributory factor to murder in a country, something like vigilantism and mob justice. Because those communities feel, you know what, there's no use in me going to SAPS. There's no use in me going to the law. We'll deal with this guy or this girl or whatever the case may be in our community. Let's zoom in on SAPS. And Maurice, I'm going to bring you in here, because we've released a report called The Broken Blue Line. I want you to tap into this. Police are at a crossroads in this country. People don't trust them because the police themselves are quite compromised in most cases. Tell us more about
that. Yeah, so we did a report called The Broken Blue Line. I wrote the third one in the series last year, and what I found was that police themselves are often involved in violent crime. They're often involved in gang-related crime and so on, and they are also they assist criminals often. I mean, we saw what happened. I forget the fellow's surname, but Chris something, Vereniging, who was selling guns to gangs in the Cape, and there was thousands of guns he sold to Cape gangs. And this is, people came and gave their guns into the police. They want to get rid of their guns. Instead of these weapons being destroyed, they went down and were used in murders and so on in the Cape. So this is just to talking about the Cape. It's quite interesting that nearly 90% or so of gang related murders are in the Western Cape.
That's right.
So that's, I mean, we all know why. I mean, that's
Parliament is situated there.
Well, that's where the gangs are.
Yeah.
And also, I think the fact that we have such a high level of murders from mob justice it's scary, it's terrifying. And, you know, people are criminals, but we don't have death penalty in this country for good reason. And there was a video going around now during the xenophobic riots. It was actually a video from a mob justice attack where a poor man had been set on fire. Who knows what he'd been done.
Well, the allegation was that he had robbed someone on the spot, and obviously the crowd then sort of surrounded
him. But doesn't matter what, if he murdered somebody, you don't set other people on fire. I mean, that's why we have a justice system, even with all its flaws. That's where you have to go. Mob justice can never be never be tolerated.
There's no due procedure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Salem. It's the Crucible. It's you're a witch.
Exactly.
Fellas, let's move it on. As I think we look at the sort of crimes that are inhibiting.
Might I add one last point on this idea of mob justice?
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating tweet from Politics Web. It's 24 years after the death penalty was abolished in South Africa. 789 public executions as part of mob justice in this past financial year. Compare that to 231, which was the highest number of lynchings recorded in America, and that was in 1892. We have, three times the level of...
Four times.
Four times the level of public executions that they had in the racist South. I mean, it's insane.
And let's not beat around the bush. These are public executions.
They are public. That's what they are.
Absolutely. And we actually forgot to raise, you know, with murder also comes attempted murder, which also went up. And the numbers there are also quite close to the murder number. You know, 18,000 attempted, 18,000 plus, 18,000, nearly 19,000, excuse me, attempted murders. And an increase from last year of about 740.
18,980.
That's right.
So, and that's also been on an upward trend over the past couple of years. So that's also something that should concern all of us.
Let's move on, guys. Let's move on. And I want us to look at the types of crimes that really begin to speak to how we're limiting the freedoms of South Africans, generally speaking. And there's a myriad of types of crimes here, you know, from sexual offenses, assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm, common assault, maybe those, let's work on those. So, in terms of assault with the intent to inflict grievous bodily harm, what do we see there, Herman?
I'm actually not quite sure.
Okay, that's quite
fair. Well, I've got it here. It's actually it stayed fairly steady. It's actually shown a decrease in the past 10 years. So in 2009-10, there were just over 200,000 incidents, and this is now 171,000.
Yeah, slight increase though, 2.2%.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it's been fairly stayed fairly. Yeah.
Common assault.
Common assault is also actually decreased. I'm saying in the past in the 10-year trend. The 10-year trend has decreased. Yeah, yeah. It has increased if we compare year to year. But common assault 10 years ago, 194,000 incidents. Now for the latest figures, 162,000. But this is up from 156,000 in the previous year. So I think what all these stats show us that the police were actually starting to win the war on crime. And but you know, they, everything was going right for the cops. If we'd carried on this trend, the murder rate would probably be in about 20 to 25 rather than 30. But I think this is all, and it happened, the police just lost, they're not as effective as they used to be, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that, and that's partly because of political meddling and who's appointed to the police. And I think, as we've seen with a lot of things in this country, we can draw it back to the election of Jacob Zuma in 2009 as president, which he hollowed out a lot of institutions in this country, including SAPS, and we're living with the consequences now.
And I also think two things to add. There is something to say for the fish rots from its head. There's the Zuma presidency really put at, which, I mean, you can, the Mandela presidency's presidency and the Mbeki presidency, they had their issues, by no, make no mistake, but we had a crook as the leader of our country. And there is no way that I think, if we look at, you know, the symbolism of power and the symbol that goes with a constitutional head of government, I think there's no way to get around the fact that people look to that as an example, as an inspiration. If the country will have a crook in charge, that will inevitably filter down. And I think that's one of the things that happened. I'm talking about hollowing out institutions, National Prosecuting Authority. Yeah. I mean, there's no chance. You can commit a crime, and the chances of you getting away with it is very, very big.
Well, this also comes to a topic we've been discussing, in fact, on this very show last week. We brought to you a snippet of what happened at the Women's March in Cape Town, as the issue, of course, of gender-based violence, and generally speaking, sexual offences, is brought to the fore. And unfortunately, some of the biggest victims of these crimes are women. Yeah. Let's look at all these sexual offences generally. As a category, they increased by 4.6% cumulatively.
Yeah, yeah.
When I talk about them being cumulative, we're talking about rape, sexual assault, attempted sexual offences, and contact sexual offences.
Yeah.
Guys, let's begin at rape, because it's the big one, I suppose. It tops the category. Let me put it that way. We see an increase of 3.9%. Why are we beginning to see? Firstly, I don't know if we have the trend in front of us.
So the trend is actually a good one.
Yeah.
10 years ago, there were nearly 50,000 rapes reported. This has gone down now to 41,000. So that's quite a big decrease. But I think with the point to make, like, where with a murder has to be reported.
Yeah.
A rape doesn't have to be reported. So who knows what the actual number is? It could actually be far higher than the 41,000 people who just reported rape. So there could be, we know the women are often treated abominably when they go report a rape in a police station. There have been many stories. I shouldn't laugh, but it's absurd. Women going to police stations to report a rape, and then the policeman raping them in turn.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's horrific. So.
And that goes back to what we were saying earlier about trust in the police. These numbers, as horrific as they are probably vast underestimation.
Mm. I mean, sexual assault is up by 9.6% and 10%.
And it's as Mario said, it just defies logic to think that that's all sexual assaults. Mm. These women are vulnerable already. Mm. And then a mistrust of the authorities, a well-deserved mistrust, might I add, of the authorities, makes that, an increase of 9% to think that's scratching the surface. I mean, it's horrible. I just need to say one thing, that if we're talking about... I went to a pretty large school. I think we were about 1,500 boys in the school. Now, if I have to imagine how many rapes happen, I have to time that by about 30. I have to take the largest group I ever was a part of, a school of 1,500 boys, I have to times that by 30. And then I can count the number of rape victims that's reflected in the official data. It's
and I think it's also one what's quite an anomaly here is that contact sexual offences that declined from 8,293 in 2009-10 to just over 1,000 for the latest year. So, and that's there must be an issue with how it's been defined, because that's a very, very big drop and doesn't make sense with looking at the other trends. So, I mean, that's we also. There might be issue with just reporting these stats as well. So,
guys, bottom line is women in this country aren't necessarily safe. There is a predatory environment out there, which, you know, we'll leave it to the feminists to give it the terms and the, you know, but the real bottom line is women in this country have their freedoms reduced by these sort of crimes. I do zoom in on women because they are the large majority of people who suffer these crimes. But now here's the problem, and we've been raising this issue on the show, and I think we need to revisit it here. Enough is enough when it comes to the rhetoric around these crimes, the activism, if you will, and the begging government to do something about it. There must be a change in approach, if you will, one which begins to empower women to begin to address these crimes directly, or empower them, rather, to be able to address these crimes directly, as we have a conversation about the state jacking itself up, police jacking its case. I mean, for example, police not having rape kits at a police station. I mean, that sort of clown world stuff has to sort of end.
And it's easy stuff to fix. Just make sure.
Absolutely. And I think you've already touched on the point of, you know, depoliticizing the police service and actually professionalizing it immensely. Maurice, before I come to you on this one, we had this conversation with the ladies in Cape Town, and one of the things I had raised with them, which I just want us to touch on briefly before we move on, was the idea that, you know, at the level of the individual, because there's distinct layers here, the individual, the community, and of course the state. At the level of the individual, there is absolutely nothing wrong in encouraging a culture, if you will, of South African women, of those who opt to, who choose to, arming themselves, getting good training, being proficient in the usage, the defensive usage of a firearm, and actually becoming a woman who can stand her ground and say, would be rapist, would be attacker. If you try and touch me, I can mete out consequences and defend my life and liberty.
Yeah.
Is this not a conversation we should be having more of?
I think so. Look, I'm probably on the... In this organization, I'm on the left of this issue because I'm not a particular fan of guns. But I do think that people, if they choose to arm themselves, and obviously you go through background checks, and we don't, you know, people have to be, you know, not have mental health issues or whatever the case may be. Well, obviously, it can't be as easy as in America, where some place you can buy a gun in Walmart, for example. But I do think people who do make the choice should be allowed to arm themselves to within reason. Of course, you can't get a pocket nuclear bomb or something, but I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a weapon to arm yourself in this country. I mean, I was held at gunpoint about a month ago, and luckily I got away with all my stuff intact. But for some people, I mean, the arming themselves would have been an option in that scenario. So, and I think, as I say, people should be allowed to have weapons if they so choose.
Herman, I'm giving this context because obviously we shot this on the day of the release of this the data. So if you're watching this, we shot this yesterday, and on the day of this episode, there's going to be, I don't know if it's happening right now as I talk technically, a Santon shutdown. It was trending on Thursday afternoon, and essentially behind it is the various sort of feminist groupings, LGBTQI types, etc., putting together a shutdown where they'll be busing people into Santon and presumably blocking roads and the like and the like. A part of me goes, yeah, activism is great, and these sort of symbolic things are fantastic, but there are people even in this hashtag who are going, guys, we really care about the issue of addressing gender-based violence, we care about addressing these sort of sexual offenses type crimes, but we just don't see why we're not moving it to the next level of putting direct pressure on the political elites, who are the ones who actually hold the power to address this, by and large. Not the corporates in Santon, who are just as hapless, really. And of course, us, the individuals, us, the ladies, a different narrative that says we can stand our ground as armed citizens and shoot those very sort of evil men who try and objectify us and harm us.
Yeah, the thing, I mean, looking at crime, it's basically the symptom of everything that's wrong with society. That's basically what it represents. So I think there's definitely a case to be made for arming women and you know, making sure that those people who are specifically vulnerable can meet out the necessary force to protect themselves. I definitely think that's part of it. But what frustrates me about the feminist movement, and I have to say I come from a house where my mother was the prime breadwinner, where I have a sister who has three beautiful children and a PhD. I mean, I come from a house and a family of incredibly strong women. My political idol is Margaret Thatcher. So it's not that I hate women. It's that I think there are certain contexts, certain structures where safety for women are enhanced, and I think the family structure happens to be one of them. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, these social structures happen to offer protection for children, for women. So you have many. It's a beast with many heads, and you can't.
Narrow it down to one thing.
But there are multiple societal factors, but I think the one thing that is also incredibly problematic is the state, if we're going to look at this philosophically. The thing that makes the state unique from another organization is it has the exclusive right to use force. Mm-hmm. And our state is losing that. Mm. If we are at the level where we have to create state power in the purse of the woman walking on the street so that she can defend herself from rape, then the state has failed, not as, you know, an economic entity, but as a fundamentally its identity as being responsible for force in society is breaking down. And South Africa, to be fair, has never really had that monopoly quite established, but that's what we should strive for.
Absolutely. Mm. Guys, we're going to move on to the last area, really, which is, I think, a more complex one. Not complex per se, but there's more categories in this one. These are crimes, of course, which are property-related. These are property-related crimes, which overall, if I can read my notes here, decreased, except with the exception... Excuse me, that kombucha came back, excuse me. Property-related crimes decreased except with the exception of stock theft, which is increased by 2.9%. Burglary at non-residential premises has stabilized. Now, I'm going to break these down a little bit.
Technically, it also went up.
Which I found a little amusing. But let me just break these down a little bit, and then we'll have a concluding conversation around these, because I think these are actually a very important layer, if you will, of crime. Burglary at non-residential households stayed static. There's no real change there percentage-wise. Burglary at residential premises saw a slight decrease of about 3.2%. Theft of motor vehicles and motorcycles saw a decrease of 4.6%. I saw the SAPs tapping themselves on the back for this one. I think this probably has a lot more to do with the private sector or the private sector, trackers and the like. Anyway, theft out of a motor vehicle or from a motor vehicle, that also went down by about 3.2%. And, of course, the last one, stock theft, which saw an increase. Let me begin with the last one because it's more important to me, I think, than the others to an extent, and I'll tell you why. we've been having a conversation around the South African farmer and just how under siege he is, both in the context of farm murders, which I think SAPS actually gave a number to,
yes.
And kudos to them for actually now beginning to track that. But stock theft is another major issue that they're dealing with, I mean, and it's becoming sophisticated and organized. Let me begin with you, Maurice. I don't know if but why I'm beginning with you is the following. We were at a one of the largest gatherings of the agricultural community earlier this year, NAMPO, and this was an issue they brought up almost consistently. To say, yes, we get the crisis of farm murders, but another massive issue is stock theft. And it isn't just animals anymore. It isn't like livestock. It's also having combines roll up onto your farm and actually gather the maize, gather the weeds, et cetera, and fly off into the night. Guys, why is this a massive problem?
Well, I think it leads to instability in the agricultural sector.
Absolutely.
And we've seen already with issues such as farm murders, it's already actually quite a dangerous profession. But we've also seen that the age of our farmers is also declining. Mm-hmm. So,
well, it's increasing.
Oh, sorry, that's mean the age of farmers average, are getting older. Yeah, yeah.
62, I think.
Exactly. So, and I think this, you don't want to be alarmist, but I mean, sorry. It is something could affect the food security of South Africa. Absolutely. Going forward. So this is something to be quite concerned about and seeing the increase.
You're right. Lump it then with the failure, for example, of the state to get agrarian restitution right, to get a young generation of mostly black farmers who want to farm, for them to get the support to be able to start agribusinesses and learn from an aging farming community. We're not even getting that right.
Oh, well, we saw now there was a recent incident with a man, I think his name is David Rakhase, and he was given a farm in the 90s. He was made a successful farm. He wants to buy it from the government now. He had to take the government to court to allow him to buy that farm. So the government is actually not interested in land reform. And we've had this conversation many times. We know the government has no real interest in building a property-owning middle class in South Africa. And if they were interested in it, they'd be giving people title deeds and so on. Not that title deeds are a silver bullet, but they definitely are. They're one of the solutions to these problems we have in this country.
And I think this forms part of the normalization of some really, really dangerous trends. The fact that we have a property-related crime category, I mean, to me, it's peak irony. This is the government that wants to commit the greatest property-related crime.
It should investigate itself, really.
Yeah, and I mean, they'll probably put that down as one incident. Oh. But so it's a normalization of what is yours isn't actually yours.
Just another thing, guys, as we really look to wrap up, and just for the benefit of my listeners, other serious crimes decreased by 1.4%, except for commercial crimes. What I mean by these is all theft mentioned elsewhere in terms of the crime data went down by 0.7%. Commercial crime, this is fraud, scams, corruption, etc., went up by 14.4%. Now, this is the one I wanted to zoom in on. Because when you have essentially an ailing economy and one which has been on a downward trend for a long time, some people will turn to certain crimes which are essentially commercial in nature. And when you see a near 15% spike in these sort of crimes, it really tells you it's the economy stupid, isn't it?
But we've seen there's lots of the malfeasance we're seeing in a lot of big companies. Apparently, before, South African companies were generally seen as quite
respectable.
Yeah, respectable. Now we've seen, I was reading an article, somebody who works in corporate South Africa was saying it's kind of like the last days of Rome. A lot of guys are just trying to get what they can before the final collapse comes, which is actually quite scary. But we've seen what's happened at places like Steinhoff. There's been, I think, Tongaat Hewlett has also had some questions around how it's functioning. So, I mean,
specifically, it's accounting, it's books.
Exactly. So there's some, I think these are all very serious issues for South Africans, and if you're not worried, you should start worrying.
And it's I mean, you're absolutely right. It's the economy, stupid. Where the moment it gets difficult to do a certain activity, that's the moment when people will resort to things they morally wouldn't countenance. I think it's the same with stock theft, and here we have. I haven't unfortunately looked into the detail of the commercial crime, but I think things like tax evasion, that's typically something that a businessman will only turn to when he feels like the his ability to feed his or her ability to feed her family is in jeopardy. And that comes back to, and I'm not talking it up, I'm not making excuses, I'm just saying that you can have circumstances where crimes are attractive, or you can have circumstances where crimes are not attractive.
Yeah.
And we are very much a country in the first category.
And I think I think if it is increasing, which is likely, it also shows there's issues with legitimacy of the state.
Mm. So I mean, SARS's tax revenue intake is underperforming
exactly.
Like crazy.
And also they're bringing in silly rules, they want to double tax expats living overseas. Mm. So what all those people do, they'll formally emigrate, and they'll financially emigrate, and maybe even give up their South African citizenship in some cases.
And cut a few corners on the way there.
Exactly, and these are kind of people who should actually, I saw in Portugal come up with a rule, if you're an expat and you move back to Portugal, you get 50% discount on your tax for 5 years or something. Mm. So that's the kind of thing, we should be encouraging South Africans who are abroad, if maybe not to come back, but to, you know, just have a positive view of the country, and doing things like that, that's not going to work.
Fellas, I'm going to wrap us up. As I do so, final comments to both of you chaps. The South African, answer this question. Is the South, and this can be a perception or also based on the numbers we've rattled out. Is the South African safer today than he was last year?
I think you can answer that in one word answer, and that's no.
I think you can answer it in one word. I think you can answer it in a few other words as well.
Mm.
I think some South Africans are safer.
You're spot on.
And I think most South Africans are not. And that comes to who can afford to put up high walls, who can afford the security guards, who can afford to emigrate, for goodness sake. I mean, those are South Africans who are now in countries where they...
A lot safer than they would
where
be.
They are. So, yes, some South Africans are safer, but it's the poor, it's the vulnerable, it's the people who the state must stand up for.
Exactly.
Who will ultimately bear the brunt of this cruelty.
And you're absolutely right. I'll give it a chance, Maurice, because I actually tweeted this out yesterday, today. You know, that it's ordinary folk like you and me, the ordinary guy on the street who does the dying because of the high murder rate, who is hijacked, who is attacked and assaulted, who faces the rapists, who deal with the property theft, etc. And
who buries their kids.
Who buries the kids.
Who has to console their daughter after something terrible happened to her.
Hashtag trust rapist. Mm. You know, but the politicians in this country, and really the political elite, I must say this, are safely ensconced behind a phalanx of, you know, armed bodyguards. And of course, they have the perfect cop to political elite ratio.
Mm.
If you go to parliament, it's teeming with police officers, for example.
Exactly.
So they don't really understand that, oh, hang on, there actually is a problem out in the streets. Maurice?
It's always vulnerable people who actually, the ones who rely on the state the most, who suffer the most when starts failing. Mm. And like you say, who are the people who suffer the brunt of crime? It's poorer people who can't afford to protect themselves with high walls or with security guards, as Harriman says. So these are people who are actually the ones suffering the most under this government and this government's failures.
And Maurice, this brings me to, therefore, what we've been advocating for here at the IOR for a very long time, that we've got to begin to have communities, individuals and communities, take charge of their own safety. Maurice, we launched a campaign. What is that campaign?
So it's our community safety charter, and we recommend some ways to change policing in South Africa. Firstly, we recommend increasing staffing and resources for family violence, child protection and sexual offences units, including expert prosecutors, improving the process of applying for and enforcing protection orders, because we heard that's a problem. A lot of women, they come and say, got a protection order against this guy, and she still ends up getting murdered or attacked by a
good example is a couple of weeks ago, champion boxer in PE had a promising career ahead of her, shot 3 times in the face by an ex-boyfriend who happens to be a cop. How's that for
So that's what I can rely on. I mean, that's one thing when I was researching that report, there were so many incidents of where policemen or policewomen probably in some cases killed their partner with their service pistol.
Other points?
Expediting the process of applying for and being granted farm licenses for self-defense.
Depends on where you're from.
Yeah, there comes my East Rand accent, license. And then establishing an inquiry and public hearings into criminality within the police, which I think is important, what we've spoken about. Making all police and prosecutorial appointments on merit alone. Increasing the powers of community police forums. Granting communities the power to elect their station commanders. And employing private sector expertise in policing.
guys, this is a solid basket of proposals that we're making that essentially, as I said, places power back into the hands of the individuals and communities, the organized groupings and communities, and of course, the communities themselves. Morris, how do people actually, who, if they endorse these ideas, how do they sign up? How do they empower the IRR to take this fight into the echelons of power?
Well, what they can do is go to our website and they'll see IRR.org.za. Mm-hmm. They'll see a campaign page there and they can go read our proposals and give their name if they like. And then also, if they are interested in our work, they can SMS their name to 32823 and that'll be one way of getting involved and becoming part of the solution. And it's your name to 32823 and each SMS costs you R1.
Absolutely, guys. Awesome, awesome conversation. I hope the listener and the viewer has been armed with the more knowledge as to what exactly transpired today, what the crime numbers said about the country you live in, the country you call home, and essentially, effectively, what you can do, the basket of ideas that you can begin to push back with for us to address the rampant crime situation in this country. Please support this campaign. This is a very important campaign that allows us to begin to address the bad ideas that are hampering our efforts to fight crime. And of course, put in place good ideas that can begin to empower you, the individual, you, the community, to fight back against crime. Remember, you can find that information on the IRR website, irr.org.za. And look for the Community Safety Charter tab on there and sign up as we'll take your voice, if you will, into the echelons of power. Guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Liberty and Friends. Remember, if you want to get things right in this country, never trust a commie.